From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Parties to the so-called P5+1 talks with Iran have apparently decided to work past the midnight Tuesday deadline in Lucerne, Switzerland, leaving observers to speculate that a deal may be near. RT's Daniel Bushell was in Lucerne and filed this report late Tuesday.
From what diplomats are telling us here at the Beau Rivage Hotel where talks take place, it looks like they're ready to keep negotiating until the early hours of Wednesday in a final push for a deal. Russia's Foreign Minister Lavrov has left for a meeting in Moscow, but is now coming back later today on signs an agreement can be reached.
The chances of reaching a deal are high. Perhaps not 100%, since there is never a 100% certainty in anything. But these chances are good. As long as no one raises the stakes at the final moment, hoping to get something extra, instead of just keeping the balance of interests.
Here's what's at stake. For Obama, a sign his administration can achieve top-level diplomacy and end 35 years of hostility and mistrust between Iran and the States. For the world, a deal can finally stop the 12-year standoff over Iran's nuclear program. But this is what still has to be agreed. Western nations want strict limits on Iran's nuclear activities for at least a decade. Tehran demands all the crippling sanctions against its population be lifted immediately once the agreement is signed. But the West claimed it's better to lift them gradually. And if Iran breaks the terms of the deal, the US and its allies want all suspended sanctions straight back.
Meanwhile, it seemed clear that if no deal was reached, another round of political football was certain to begin in Washington. RT's Kevin Owen has more on that.
America's been laboring hard for a deal despite criticism from its allies, Saudi Arabia and Israel. The Obama administration is also facing staunch opposition at home from the Republicans who already want to impose more sanctions on Tehran. In fact, in an interview with CNN, House Speaker John Boehner was asked how quickly congressional Republicans could potentially impose new restrictions on Iran if no agreement was reached today. Boehner's answer was very concise to that and short. He said, very, very quickly. Also, to obstruct a possible deal, Senator John McCain suggested that Israel should even go, quote, rogue on Iran if it needs to. Let's get more analysis on this and talk to Middle East commentator Mir Javed Damfer, who's joining us on the line now. Hi, sir. There seems to be some optimism, but as we've been hearing from other participants at that meeting as well over the last 24 hours, a mixed picture. So it depends who you're listening to. What is your take on it? Where do you think it's going to go? The Russian side, pretty optimistic. What about you?
Well, Kevin, it's very, very difficult to predict what's going to happen. The people who are doing the negotiations, they are keeping it, they're doing a very good job of keeping everything secret, make sure nothing leaks outside. From the little that we know so far, it could go either way, but I would say the chances that they're going to reach an agreement just to allow them to continue negotiating until the end of June, that's probably the likeliest. I think at this stage, Iran nor the P5+1 want the talks to break down. So they're probably going to come up with something temporary to enable them to negotiate until the end of June. If they can't reach an agreement at the end of June, then everybody's going to be in trouble.
According to a New York Times report late Tuesday, the talks may be extended through Wednesday, and we'll have more on that tomorrow. Nigeria is apparently set for a new president. With ballots in 35 of 36 regions counted, Muhammadu Buhari, the candidate of Nigeria's main opposition group, the All Progressives Congress, or APC, has apparently won the presidential election over the country's incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan. Buhari, himself a former military dictator in Nigeria, called the vote historic, saying, quote, "This is the first time the opposition has voted a government out of power in Nigeria's history," closed quote. With 35 of the 36 states declaring results, Buhari had polled 14.9 million votes to the sitting president's 12.8 million, a lead of more than 2 million votes, with the remaining state being in Buhari's stronghold in the country's north, which has been hit hardest by violent attacks from the group Boko Haram. Nigerians turned out en masse to vote in the presidential election over the weekend. The country's almost 60 million registered voters also cast their ballots in parliamentary elections, with 739 candidates competing for a place in Nigeria's 109-seat Senate and 1,780 seeking election to the 360-seat House of Representatives during the parliamentary vote. For more, we spoke with Abiyomi Ezekwe, publisher of the Pan-African Newswire, via Skype Tuesday. It appears that President Goodluck Jonathan's luck may have run out, and there's going to be a new president in Nigeria.
Yes, and it appeared initially to be a very close race, but they're saying that he had over 2 million more votes, Muhammadu Buhari, than Goodluck Jonathan. So it's a major development as far as African politics are concerned, but I'm not exactly sure in terms of how it's really going to impact the conditions of ordinary people living in Nigeria.
One thing that's interesting is that prior to the election results being published, there were accusations by the new president that the existing leadership was so corrupt that you couldn't trust the outcome of the election. Now that he's won, do you think he's going to change his tune?
Well, obviously, he's going to change his tune. There were reports that members of the military, at the behest of the ruling People's Democratic Party, was trying to intimidate people at various collation and vote counting centers across the country. But apparently, it wasn't enough to sway the vote in the direction of President Goodluck Jonathan. The conditions right now in Nigeria are so critical. It's not surprising that many people would vote against the PDP. The Boko Haram insurgency has been intensified over the last year. The kidnapping of the schoolgirls in Chibok in Borno State was a major issue across Nigeria, and it even took on international dimensions. The fact that the military under Goodluck Jonathan was not able to curtail the advances of Boko Haram until recently, it's a strong indication that there was some type of divide between the military and the civilian government. So we'll have to see if this offensive against Boko Haram continues. There has to be an assessment of the actual effectiveness of it and what the character of it is going to be in terms of the military's approach to developments in the Northeast, as well as Boko Haram itself and how it responds to the new regime.
Okay, and on that note, we'll leave it there for now, and we'll be back in touch with you as things develop. Thank you very much, Abiyomi Ezekwe.
Thank you.
The Secretary General of the Union of South American Nations, or UNASUR, has issued a call for the removal of all U.S. military bases from Latin America. In an interview, UNASUR's Secretary General Ernesto Samper said that next month's Summit of the Americas in Panama could serve as the place to, quote, reassess relations between the U.S. and South America, closed quote. Samper said that, quote, a good point on the new agenda of relations would be the elimination of U.S. military bases, a leftover from the days of the Cold War and other conflicts, close quote. At the summit, which is set for April 10th and 11th, all eyes are expected to be on U.S. President Barack Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro. It will be the first time that Cuba has participated since being ousted from the Organization of American States in 1962. However, the UNASUR Secretary General believes the attention on Cuba-U.S. relations should not overshadow issues such as the U.S. militarization of the region and its base in Guantanamo Bay. In 2009, UNASUR held a special meeting of member states to discuss Colombia's intention of allowing U.S. troops access to 7 military bases within that country. Ultimately, the regional bloc voted instead to declare the continent a, quote, region of peace, closed quote. Meanwhile, in Venezuela, over 5 million people thus far have signed a petition demanding that President Obama repeal his executive order declaring the Socialist Bolivarian Republic an extraordinary threat to U.S. national security. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro expects to present the petition to the U.S. president with 10 million signatures at the summit in Panama City next month. Brazil is the latest member of a new China-led international bank that appears to include every major economic power in the world except for one, the U.S. Brazil is Latin America's largest economy and the second largest in the Western Hemisphere behind the U.S. It's also one of the members of the so-called BRICS group, which consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. For more, we go to Press TV's Ben Tavena, who filed this report from Sao Paulo.
Brazil has accepted an invitation from China to join the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, despite the United States warning several of its allies against the move. President Dilma Rousseff had previously said Brazil was very interested in joining as a founding member of the China-led investment bank, which will finance infrastructure projects in the Asia-Pacific region. The bank was launched last year with around 20 countries initially laying the groundwork, headed by China. But at least 20 more nations have now signed up, including the United Kingdom, Russia and Switzerland.
This is simple, an offer they had to accept. Brazil's ties with China have grown exponentially over the last decade, given China's growing status as a world power and now as Brazil's biggest trade partner. Brazil could not have let this opportunity pass by.
Even though a number of countries declaring their interest in the Asian Investment Bank have strong links with the United States, including Brazil, commercial interests appear to have won out on this occasion.
As Brazil's economy relies on commodities such as iron ore and soybean, it's more interesting to China, which needs these raw materials as a partner. Brazil, which is diplomatically fairly unimportant, despite its size, is veering more towards an increasingly powerful China rather than the United States.
Washington is concerned over how the new China-led bank would be run and its potential impact on global lenders it dominates, such as the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the Asian Development Bank, which the US fears could lose influence. While the US and Japan remain skeptical about the venture, Denmark and Australia have also now signaled their intention to join. The number and breadth of countries wanting to join the new investment bank has taken both Washington and Beijing by surprise. Several countries joining the new China-led investment bank have said that their decision doesn't preclude them from working with other global lenders such as the IMF. But many will undoubtedly see this as a strategic shift away from institutions dominated by the United States. Ben Taverner, Press TV, São Paulo.
Hua Chunying, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry, confirmed Tuesday that 30 countries have been approved thus far as founding members of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Among the new bank's founding members are such traditional U.S. allies as Australia, Egypt, the U.K., France, India, the Philippines, Switzerland, and South Korea. The bank is expected to launch operations by the end of this year and is sometimes viewed as a competitor to the existing U.S.-dominated development institutions such as the World Bank and IMF. China is playing a key role in supporting the establishment of three new multilateral development finance institutions, which include the bank and the new BRICS Development Bank and the Silk Road Fund. It committed $40 billion U.S. dollars to the establishment of the Silk Road Fund, which has already become operational. Together, the AIIB and Silk Road Fund will provide a major boost to infrastructure funding for transportation and energy in Southeast and Central Asia. On June 14, 2012, Lorenzo Johnson, whose wrongful conviction was finally overturned by a federal court, turned himself in to go back to prison, again serving out a sentence of life without parole for a murder in 1995 that he insists he did not commit. After serving more than 15 years of his sentence, with a trail of paper and proceedings through both the federal and state court systems, Johnson's claim of innocence was accepted by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which decided that the state had failed to prove his guilt and ordered him released. Upon his release, prosecutors took his case before the U.S. Supreme Court, which ordered him back to prison on May 29, 2012. In this sixth installment of the investigation into his case, we discussed with Lorenzo Johnson the significance of the adjournment last Friday of a scheduled court appearance where he was called to testify in the case of his co-defendant and about the status of his own case. The hearing got postponed. Let's start with that. Tell us what's up.
I was supposed to go to court Friday on the 27th, and I guess the judge postponed it. At this moment, I don't have a new date. You know, we're going to wait a week, and then we'll get back in touch with, you know, the judge's chambers and the attorney general office to see what's going on, to proceed on, so it won't be no more delays. But I've been waiting since my appeal been in front of my trial judge since August of 2013, I believe.
Wow.
So it's been a minute.
And
this call is subject to recording and monitoring.
And so, you know, we filed three supplements with newly discovered evidence. You know, more police corruption, in prosecution misconduct. You know, we came across more things that was hidden from us for 19 years that they never turned over to the defense where we had a right to. And, you know, it's like a lot of delay tactics been taken.
Yeah, so the hearing you were supposed to go to on Friday was actually over your co-defendant's lawyer, right? They're trying to have her removed from the case or something?
Yeah, they tried to, well, they didn't try. They submitted some paperwork to get the judge to disqualify my co-defendant's attorney, which is, I'm thinking they should disqualify themselves for, you know, the injustice that's been done to me and my co-defendant.
Really?
But, you know, all of a sudden, this hearing sprung up and I was subpoenaed to come.
Yeah, that's the interesting irony there is that this is over some procedural aspect of, in grand terms, conflict of interest, but just because you and your co-defendant have, you know, separate cases, basically, whereas the ethical violation that they've continued to commit for the whole time you've been in prison, they're still allowed to continue to carry the case.
Exactly, man, and that's what's really odd, and I would like society to take a look at that. It's like you could withhold evidence for 19 years of my innocence, which under Brady versus Maryland, you know, a defendant has a right to favorable evidence that's in the prosecution's case to turn it over. That's in their file. And this didn't take place for 19 years, and they fought me tooth and nail. Not only while I was in prison, when my case was vacated and I was discharged, they still fought me knowing that they used false testimony to bring me back. And now when we uncover it 19 years later, they blame me and my attorneys for not finding this sooner. How could we find something that you have in your file that you never turned over?
Right. That's right.
So, you know, it's definitely an eye-opener. But like I said, I'm one of many. I'm not the only case that this takes place with, you know. You see the record numbers of exonerated, you know, cases over the last couple of years. Like
this call is subject to recording and monitoring.
It's getting really out of hand right now.
Yeah, once they started applying DNA tests to physical evidence, they started finding out that whole chunks of people that were in prison were innocent just using that
exactly.
Tool. So you filed in August of 2013 and three supplementals since. When was the last paper filed, and what's the status of everything with that?
We just filed a reply 2 weeks ago, and in our reply, we replied to they replied. It took 2 years to reply to us. They said they was going to do an investigation, and we should have known from the door that they wasn't going to do an honest investigation, because that would mean they would be investigating themselves.
Right.
So they prolonged it 2 years with continuances, and they traded us information that we never had in our file so we could give them continuances. Ain't that something? And they traded us a couple different times to get 90-day continuances, almost 2 years of continuances.
So
then they turned around and filed on Christmas Eve. Now, they said they was going to do a good faith investigation and look into my innocent claims. The only thing they argue when they reply is not the evidence, not my innocence, is timeliness, saying that I didn't file on time.
Yeah, so what happens here basically is this. After you have a federal appeals court release you, saying that you weren't sufficiently proven guilty, knowing that they have never provided you this evidence that you were innocent, even though they were required to, they go back to court and push the case all the way to the Supreme Court and get you returned to prison to serve a life sentence. Then you file papers, and in August of 2013, they begin stalling. Instead of replying in 30 days or whatever, they buy two more years of you being in prison while they leak to you on occasion in exchange for the continuances, further
exactly.
Proof that you're innocent.
Exactly.
Wow. And meanwhile, you're still in prison.
And I'm sitting in prison on December 24th on New Year's. They filed their reply, and they don't argue any of the facts in this case. They
right.
Strictly go on procedural defaults and timeliness when they were the one that withheld this evidence.
Right. They said basically, you know, this evidence that we just gave him, well, he didn't plead it back during the trial, so it's too late now. He can stay in prison.
Yeah, they said that. They saying that I could have found this evidence. I could have found this evidence sooner. How could I find evidence sooner that you hid from me? And then they also accused me and my legal team of defaming the career cop and the career prosecutor. Well, you put somebody in jail for 19 years and you hold evidence of their innocence, and when they let the society know what's going on, you said that you're the one that's defamed. Ain't that something?
That's right. Yeah, truth is an absolute defense. That's right. So, well, besides just sitting there waiting, what can you be doing proactively?
I mean, we could you go to freelorenzojohnson.org, sign my freedom petition, get involved. You know, I'm encouraging others to speak about my injustice to further my story, you know. And, you know, thanks to social media nowadays, like, you know, I see that as injustice's worst nightmare because you could put facts out there. I argue facts. I argue the law and the evidence, which is on my side. You know, I'm not worried about nothing coming out of a closet. I'm innocent. I've been saying that from day one. Like, I encourage people to get involved and research the case and see what's going on.
Yeah, like the kind of facts that you're talking about, for example, is testimony from people that on the day of the murder, you were not in the city that the murder took place in, but rather a couple hundred miles away in New York.
And not only that, you know, your only witness, your chief witness, you know, was labeled a suspect the couple of days after the homicide, with witnesses saying that she was with the deceased, that she was a suspect. This evidence also was never given to us until 19 years later. An attorney general told the jury that you have to listen to this witness because this witness has no reason to lie. Obviously, this witness had a lot of reasons to lie if you labeled this witness a suspect and never told anybody until almost 20 years later.
And in a series of interviews from the time of the murder up until the trial, basically, she was telling an entirely different story, and they recorded that on paper, and never provided you with that either.
Never gave me the original statement. We only had the police summary to find out that, you know, her written statement, well, one of them, because some of them is still missing. We still don't got all of the statements yet also. But the one that they did turn over was contrary to the one that was set at trial. Now, here it is. The prosecution let from the preliminary hearing to trial, my direct appeal, my post-conviction relief act appeal, my federal appeal, all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, the prosecutors let false fraud testimony stand without correcting it.
And that was the only testimony that placed
That's
you at the scene?
That's the only testimony of someone said that I was standing there, that I was there.
Well, okay. We'll talk with you, I guess, next week again when we find out what the story is with that hearing on your co-defendant's lawyer, and we'll update people about that.
Exactly.
Thank you.
I'll be back next live with Don DeBar next week.
Thanks, man. The family of imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal has reportedly been allowed to visit. There weren't many details available as of press time, but for more information, you can go to the website, prisonradio.org, and we'll have more tomorrow. A new model of community police review board may be rolled out soon in Newark, New Jersey. One where the members of the board can subpoena witnesses and conduct independent fact findings features strongly opposed by police thus far successfully throughout the U.S. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford spoke with Larry Hamm, who chairs the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, about the new board's powers and the ongoing political wrangling over the issue of police accountability.
As police review boards go, if we use the executive order as a measurement, it will be, I would say, probably one of the more effective police review boards. First and foremost, because most of the civilian police complaint review boards in the United States don't have subpoena power. And this executive order would give the police review board subpoena power. So that puts it ahead of the overwhelming majority of police review boards right there.
But the sticking point so far has been the question of whether the board would have the final say on disciplinary measures against police.
That is correct. And that is one of the steps that still remains to be accomplished. And the question of the board's input into the disciplinary process came up during the hearing. And what's going to happen, I believe, is that once the board is formed, the board, together with the police director, will develop a matrix. The matrix essentially would be a guideline in terms of what offenses are punishable and what the punishments would be.
You seem to be saying that the central problem might not be worked out until after the board actually is in existence.
I would say so. And I was one of the first speakers. And that is the question that I asked, is at what point will the police review board, I asked this directly of the mayor, at what point would the police review board actually be in existence? And he said he estimates the end of 2015, the beginning of 2016. So the matrix could come up before the actual first meeting, because he envisions the step-by-step process where the board members may actually be identified by as early as the fall of 2015. But then they will go through some training and some preliminary development before they actually begin their work as a police review board. So it could be at that point, if not before, that people actually start to sit down and try to put this matrix together, that is the guidelines on disciplinary measures for the police. Because remember, the review board executive order already identifies five community organizations that will have representation on the board. And as a result of this hearing, it could very well be that the board's number may increase, because one of the things that happened at the hearing was that there were other community organizations who requested to have representation on the board. And it seemed that the mayor, and I may be reading into his comments, he did not say, well, I'll put you on the board, I'll put your group will have. He did say that he's open to some consideration about how to include more community organizations in this process.
As this process moves along, does it appear that this is going to require some kind of enabling legislation from outside of Newark, like the New Jersey State Legislature?
I would almost bet my next paycheck that the mayor does not want to go in that direction. Because if he does, that legislation would surely fail. I do not see this New Jersey legislature as being a body that could approve any enabling legislation for any civilian entity that would have oversight on the police. This legislature is it's not Republican dominated, but it certainly is suburban dominated. And it's also a party machine dominated legislature. And people must keep in mind that the police are not only a paramilitary force, they are a political force. And they exert political pressure upon elected officials. And I could not see any legislation related to the establishment of police review boards that would get through this legislature anytime soon. And that's why, and again, this is my speculation, there have been no direct comments to this effect, but I believe this is why the mayor is establishing the review board through executive order. Because I think that if he tried to do it through a municipal ordinance, that it could not get through the city council. I don't think it could get through the city council. I believe the police would exert too much influence over the city council people. It would either get bogged down in committee or it would get voted down if it got out of committee. And this is why I believe the mayor is trying to establish this through an executive order.
And this is in a city that has been under at least nominal black rule since 1970 and has had a predominantly black city council since that time. And still, a community review board doesn't have, apparently, sufficient power to pass.
What can I say? But yes, this attempt to establish the review board, which I do believe will be established, this attempt to establish the review board gives you some insight into the class contradictions, racial contradictions, and political contradictions that exist when black people do have at least nominal control of municipal government.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.